Action.
Okay.
What? There was a book that came out a few years ago that was like sort of Robbie Nachman-like, that had a kind of greenish cover, and it was something, something, something on Aiden. I personally found it incredibly annoying, but like a lot of people loved it.
Yes, I know. The Garden of Amunah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, that was really annoying. Do you have it?
I think I might be able to find the one.
It's
very
flowery.
I know what you're...
Okay, so we were at the intro. We were at the end of the show last time. We set up the claim of Dr. Steinberg that there were two principles of halacha, or two principles of autonomy that halacha conflicted with. We established that the principle of autonomy per se, is not really the issue. The issue is coercion, and when it turned down that really the evidence for coercion was just the moroksia, and then when we went to the moroksia, we discovered that actually it has a very limited, sphere for coercion. It turns out that coercion really only applies to cases where there is where you're definitely going to die. All right, we believe the consequence of your action is definite death, and you agree with that. Right, but the Rabbi doesn't seem to allow you to take even wild risks for this. Right, as long as we could not classify what you were doing as going out to commit suicide, ibud as molada. Right, so Jonathan pointed out afterwards, which is, you know, that the contemporary psak is actually on the whole more restrictive. We use a principle called Shomer Psa'im Hashem, which, right, as a control of what kind of risks you're allowed to enter into, which seems to set some kind of reasonable social standard model or something like that. Not entirely clear. I contend that Rav Yaakov Emden, if he uses that standard, he uses it a lot more expansively than we do nowadays. Right, it sounds to me like he thinks that even because he says sometimes people survive the operation, so you can't stop them. Right? It's not normal risk. That's what he says, right? Yesh tamim shei vashay, right? So tamim vashay. Now, what we're not doing risk per se. So what I'm interested in is what seems to me to emerge from Yaakov Emden was that broad principle that really anytime anything other than suicide is left to the discretion of the patient. And the question is, why shouldn't we just treat that as suffix suicide? Right? Suffix suicide, right? So, you know, right, you might be killing yourself, so you shouldn't do it, right? That's normally the way in which we function, right? Is something is vadayasur, you shouldn't, right? If something else, if it's definitely going to happen, you shouldn't do it. If it's a suffix, it's going to happen. It's going to happen either. Yes, Mish?
Is it possible that there's, by definition, there's no such thing as suffix suicide? Because if essentially Hashem has control over your life, suicide would be taking your living or death into your own hands. But something where you're saying, like let's say, you know, there's a possibility, all right, maybe I'll live, maybe I'll die, it's still Hashem's choice to control the reality. So there's no way, like if you put yourself in a suffix suicide situation, it's still not your causing it. You're setting up a situation where Hashem now still has two choices over whether to let you live or die.
Okay.
So the roulette is okay.
Right, that's exactly right. Exactly right. That's the Nafkamina. The Nafkamina is Russian roulette. So I would like to believe with David that again, then doesn't address the question of a suffix it entered into for no purpose at all. But it seems I would think the implication of what he's saying is that you can enter into a risk for a gain. But to risk your life for no gain, he would still think is usur. But I agree that he doesn't address it explicitly enough. But that's enough kamina, right? Does he think it's okay to play Russian roulette?
So no, it would be usur, but under a different category. It would be usur, not under suicide, but under risking your health.
So what's usur about risking your health, according to him?
Being healthy in general.
I don't know. He doesn't mention it. That's our whole issue, right? Why doesn't he just say? Then he could say that about risk also, right? But he allows risk for gain. Right? He doesn't say you're violating Mishnah Artemelo Nafsho Seichem. Why? why should pain allow you, right? Then it should be a question of the chiyah. This pushes aside that.
Yeah.
All right? But he doesn't frame it that way. He frames it as you can't commit suicide, and after that it's discretionary. But his only examples are where you're doing it to avoid pain or things like that. So I would rather not leave it in the realm of suicide of just probability. I would rather try and actually make a reverse argument for Yaakov Emden that he really thinks autonomy is valuable, and you should have the right to make decisions, but you don't have the right to make a decision that your life is valueless. That's the restriction. Right? You have to make decisions on the premise that life is valuable. Having made that decision, we can then talk about how valuable. That's how I'd like to set it up. Whether it's convincing or not, I'm not sure. I think at the very least what we can say is that Yaakov Emden is not really helpful for Dr. Steinberg's thesis. Right? He might not be as damaging as I want to write. I want to argue that it's actually a contrary principle. Right? Yaakov Emden's limitation of the prohibition of suicide to cases of vadai is actually an affirmation of autonomy, that the only place in which it's restricted is that. And I want to make clear that I don't think we paskin that way at all. I think Rav Yaakov Emden is really radically liberal on that. But at the very least, Rav Yaakov Emden doesn't serve as proof of any kind of broad principle of limitation of autonomy, because the whole thrust of him is to create space for autonomy. Yes?
I don't think Dr. Steinberg reads the Morafia incorrectly. He just presents the Matthias as if most of the cases were in that Vadai case, and we are assuming that most of the cases are not. But it's his presentation of the Matthias that's wrong, not his presentation of the Morafia.
I don't think there's a halachic misrepresentation. He doesn't do it in any kind of depth. He just quotes the one case. I don't think it's a relationship to fact which way the cases are. I'm dealing with the theory of it.
Dr. Steinberg acknowledges that in cases based on that work theory, that in cases where it's not vadai, we would have faith in autonomy. He just pretends that those cases are very rare.
See, I don't think it's a question of rarity. I think it's a question of perspective. Do you say that really our goal is to compel you, but somehow the existence of a doubt prevents us from compelling you, because how do we impose, right, because it prevents us from imposing on you? And the other perspective is, no, that really our goal is to provide autonomy, but in some cases, that's just, right, we just can't do that, right? You can't go that far.
So both of those, I think, are equally legitimate readings of the Morafia.
So I think the second one is a better reading. It doesn't feel to me, and I think that there are places where it's that he's saying, well, we would impose this on you, but there's a suffix, because there's an easy mechanism for avoiding that. The mechanism for that is rove. Right? We can turn any rove into a vadai.
Which rove?
We can say 51% is a vadai, right? And that radically increases the number of cases that become vadai. We also have a mechanism called suffix pikuach nefesh, right? Which we use also, right? So we can just say any suffix of pikuach nefesh.
Rove on what? On what I'm
going to
do?
Rove on what the outcome is. So we can impose, right? Any case which has a 51% chance of death, we can treat it as vada pikuach nefesh. We treat rove as vada everywhere else in the world. Why should pikuach nefesh?
Except when it's kavua.
Yeah, he doesn't pull out kavua here, and what the parameters of kavua and rove are also open to question. And as I say, pikuach nefesh dafka, in other areas, we just decide that suffix equals vada. Right, we're not constrained in every other area of pikuach nefesh. We're not constrained by the problem of suffix. We just say suffix equals vadai. So for him to claim, but here, right, it has to be absolutely vadai, right, bedukah gemurah, and any element of suffix reduces it. That to me is militates in favor of the second reading. Questions? Yes.
When he says "bduka gmura vadai," he means that about the present, that meant any spiritual.
Sorry.
כשהוא אומר "vadai" אז בהתחלה הוא לא משתמש במילים "bduka". יש לו כמה פירושים ל"vadai". בהתחלה זה באמת לא בדוחה ומורה, רק בשנייה זה בדוחה ומורה, ואני חושבת שכשהוא אומר בדוחה, אז אני לא יודעת אם אולי זה בכלל לא מתכוון למספר האחוזים, אלא לניסיון ממשי שיש בזה, אפילו יותר מזה, להבנה. זאת אומרת, האם, ולכן זה נראה לי החלוקה שהייתה אז, בשיעור הקודם, בין פנימי לחיצוני, שבפנימי אתה לא יודע מה יש שם בפנים. וחיצוני זה לא רק של אחוזים, שאתה יודע כמה מניסיון, זאת אומרת שזה גם מובן, הוא גם נושא, איך קורא לזה גם עוד? לא רק בדוקה, אלא ידיעה ודאית והכרה ברורה בהם.
כן.
שזה הרבה יותר מובן, זאת אומרת, אם נניח אתה שם יוד על פצע, אז אתה מבין את זה, זה ידיעה ברורה.
עם הבנה.
זה לא רק, כאילו כן, עם הבנה, זה לא רק הניסיון של הבדוקה. בדקתי כמה פעמים וזה באמת ככה.
אז אני מסכים לזה, אבל מה שאני אומר שבדרך כלל בהלכה לא צריכים כזה, לא צריכים, לא צריכים, זה עוד רעש או צריכים, האם יש אחוז יותר מ-50?
האם צריך את ה...
50 ו-51, דרך כלל, 51 זה רוב וזה עולה כאילו זה 100%. לא צריכים ידיעה ברורה, כל הביטויים האלה אומרים שהוא כאן מצריך יותר ממשהו מצריך בשאר פעתי הלכה לעניין ודאי.
אני חושבת שמבחינתו ידיעה של אחוזים היא לא משנה כלום, היא כמו הפנימית. זה בסדר, זה יכול להיות שזה הלך, יכול להיות שזה לא הלך. אם אתה מבין את זה, אם זה הכרה, והכרה, ידיעה ודאית והכרה ברורה, אז זה בכלל לא עניין של אחוזים.
אבל אני לא חולק. אני רק אומר שבדרך כלל בהלכה האחוזים הם באמת נשנים. לומר שזה לא תלוי באחוזים כאן, אלא צריכים עניין של ודאות ממש, כן, זה חידוש.
שזה כאילו מעבר ל-51?
כן.
אוקיי.
זה הטענה שלי. And in general, ספק, in terms of פיקוח נפש, ספק doesn't require, right? פיקוח נפש, we say even 1%, right? אפילו אחוז אחד, דרך כלל לפיקוח נפש לחילול שבת, זה מספיק. אז מדוע זה לא מספיק לכפייה?
ואז אמרת שזה בגלל שזה הרבה ספקות, שזה...
לא, אני חושב בשביל שהוא אוהב את האוטונומיה. אז הוא אומר, כן, הוא אומר בשביל זה, שאף שבכלל ספק, דרך כלל פיקוח נפש ספק אפילו אחוז אחד, אפילו אחוז אחד מספיק, כשאנחנו משתמשים בפיקוח נפש בניגוד לאוטונומיה, אז צריכים הכרה ברורה וידיעה וכדומה. זה חידוש גדול.
זה כאילו פשוט ערך שעומד מול זה.
כן. זה מה שאני טוען, שבאמת רדאג אנדין מעריך את האוטונומיה. ולא מתנגד לזה. Okay, we could talk at other points about, right, there's a whole broader shir I have about the whole nature of safek, and right, with just pointing out that I think it's valuable to point out tangentially that the category safek is a fungible category. We all know that 100% is vadai one way and 0% is vadai the other way, and anything between 0 and 100 could be a safek. Right, that's one model. A second model is that we use rove. So everything between 50.0, everything between 0 and 49.9 infinitely repeating is vadai one way, and everything between 50. Pardon?
Not infinitely repeating, but that equals 50.
Who says we accept limits? Okay.
I'm walking out of this year if we don't.
I had a lot of problems with limits in high school, but if it makes you happy, right, 40.9 repeating infinity minus one times.
Oh, okay.
Hey, whereas the... I would say, like, the story I always say, sports tell, the story I would tell about this is... at a general assembly many years ago, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg got up and gave a shiur about how he had been given up sort of on certain types of aspects of chosenness, because all human beings have infinite value, and when he came to realize that all humans have infinite value, he recognized that you couldn't make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. And I raised my hand and I said, but it's not true that all infinites are have equal. Just say that's something against it, right? Many mathematicians hold us that infinity plus one is greater than infinity. So why can't we fit all even the infinite value?
Infinity plus one is not greater than infinity, but two to the infinity power.
Okay, right. Whatever the whole Hilbert's hotel, right? All that, right? The whole gamma. All infinities are commensurate. And at that point, all the social workers in the room fell asleep. It was math, total math disinterest. But I have my credential. All right, I've done this for real. all right. Okay. When my grandfather on my father's side married my grandmother, but he was tahered for a week and he finally got through because he recited Yivamot Baal Peh. When I married Deborah, I was tahered on whether I could follow the notion of a fractal. Right, a fractal dimension. my father-in-law has yarmulke with a silver curve. And back then I could. okay. So, that's so the should recognize the category of safek is a fungible category. Again, it could be 50.01 to 100, 101 repeating. That one can repeat infinitely because it won't go down to 50, right? Right, so 50.01 repeating into you don't even need that though. 50.01 is larger, right? So 0 repeating with the one at the end.
There are no infinitesimals.
Right, right. 200 is wrote that way, and 49.9 with the qualifiers mentioned previously below is infinitely little. And the only case of safek is exactly even, and that model, the only cases of safek, obviously, are constructed sfikot, right? Artificial 50-50 cases, which is what we call kavua. Right? No case is really 50-50, but there's a certain set of halachic parameters in which we say that we treat this as if it's 50-50 no matter what. But these create totally different religious sensibilities, because in one religious sensibility, all of life is how to navigate the probabilities. Right? How do you deal with safek? Right? If you think that everything less than 100 is safek, so then your life, you never have deal with certainties in life, you only deal with sfeikot. And the only thing that matters in life is safek deraisa l'chumra, safek derabanan l'kula. Right, that's how you make every decision in life. And on the other hand, in the other universe, you never need to know about it. Right, so I argued in a presentation I gave to the conference some years ago that this is the difference between the Kitur Shulchan Aruch and the Mishneh Berurah, that if you read the Kitur Shulchan Aruch, the entire Kitur Shulchan Aruch will discover that the term derabanan only shows up in like 13 times in the whole book, and when it does, it's only to more than half the time is to tell you it doesn't make a difference whether it's derabanan or deraisa. I think 7 out of the 13 or something, right? It's to tell you they have dealt in derabanan, right? Whereas in Mishneh Berurah it's all hundreds of times, and that's because the Aruch HaShulchan, this I learned from my grandfather, my mother's side, who never understood. I always get upset at these. My friends, the YU guys, would come in and give shiurim explaining that something was only Darabanan, who cares? I'd look at him and say, what do you care? It's only Darabanan Lakula. That's because I live in a world of fake code, but he didn't. He lived in a world in which if it wasn't 100, right, in which if it wasn't exactly 50-50, you decided based on rote. So why would something ever come up? Right, those are very, very different. I think a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch sensibility is a radically different sensibility than a Mishneh Berurah sensibility, and it's really worth thinking about. How one trains people to recognize uncertainty or to just make decisions. But I think Rav Yaakov Emden makes a very strong decision to limit the category of vadai, right, dramatically. And I think that it's plausible, although I don't think it's compelling. Although you may decide it's compelling or decide this is wrong. It's plausible that he does this because he sets value on the capacity to make your own decisions. Right, so he really limits the category, of vaday. Okay, so now this was supposed to be when I said this, to test Steinberg's second thesis, which was that Platonic informed consent depends on a notion of the person owning the body, and we will avoid the philosophic morass of what constitutes the person that owns the body. Right, so I said there were two ways in which we had to test that thesis. One is the instances of rhetorical uses of the phrase "you don't own your body," and the other is the other is substantive laws, right, that might depend on the premise that you don't own your body. And so the Shulchan Aruch Harav was the first case where we really were largely dealing with rhetoric. Right, he says, "Ke'en l'adam reshut al gufo klal." But when we analyzed it, we discovered that "Ein l'adam reshut al gufo klal" was problematic for Dr. Steinberg's thesis in a number of ways. One is that it seemed to be framed in terms of pleasure and pain, as opposed to in terms of health. Now, we didn't really understand why pleasure and pain should be relevant to God anyway. Right? Why is, just because God owns your body, why does the body have to experience pleasure? Weish argued that maybe, you know, there's some empathetic mode, right? I forget the exact formulation you had. In which God is a human being, so our pain is his pain. Imo anachi v'tzara, in a very, very literal sense. Right? Every pain, we feel God's pain. Okay. But it doesn't support the health thesis. Right, which is what he wants with, right? Which is what Dr. Steinberg wants it for, that you have an obligation to keep your body in good health. Maybe an obligation to live a hedonistic life, regardless of your health.
Why is that a support for
a
hedonistic life?
Because if God has pleasure and we have pleasure, and pain and we have pain, we should have lots of pleasure.
Pleasure, spiritual pleasure as well, and intellectual pleasure as well.
Sure.
It would be saying that a hedonistic life is not an evil, and yet at the same time, it is not the utmost.
Right, but why is health relevant? That's my question.
Why not?
Because why does it matter if you live a life, right? Why does it matter in this calculus?
You have less pleasure if you're unhealthy.
You have less pleasure if you're unhealthy. In this calculus, I had a choice of living a really happy 6 months or a painful 2 years. Right? The calculus may, on that level, the calculus is pleasure beats pain.
If you're looking at pleasure in a purely hedonistic sense rather than the spend it out of what pleasure is, you're right. Look, if you're looking at, like, a person has no other pleasures rather than physical pleasures, okay, fine, you're right. But 2 years of experiencing physical pain doesn't mean that those 2 years don't also experience, you know, immense spiritual pleasure, which outweighs the physical pleasure.
That's fine, but he doesn't mention that when he talks about this. He doesn't mention that. Right? The Shulchan Aruch Harav doesn't mention the overwrite, you can experience pain for the sake of other kind of energy, just as your responsibility is to not have your body experience pain. He doesn't talk about your experience.
Yeah, what if you're in so much pain that you won't be able to learn?
Yeah, that's a real thing. I don't know. Right, so then he says, and the second thing he says is that in fact you are allowed to experience pain so long as you have a spiritual purpose. Right, now the question is, well, what constitutes a valuable purpose? So now, you know, so that it doesn't really limit autonomy that way either. It just, right, all it does is it sets the framework and value of values in which you ought to exercise autonomy. Right, and lastly, it doesn't say anything whatsoever about whether we coerce you. Right, you're not allowed to. It's not the same as saying that we, right, if you were to take this argument to its logical extreme, we would say, well, here I am, I walk into lunch, and I say, you know what, I don't feel like eating ice cream today. Why don't you feel like eating ice cream today? Because it's just not important to me. I'm just not important to me. I would, today I feel anhedonic. I don't really feel the desire to experience pleasure. Well, tough, right? Pick me up, right? Drag me over and shove the ice cream down my throat. Right? Because I am failing. No. If we believe in Kriya, right? Shouldn't we believe in Kriya for that too?
No longer pleasure.
Oh, because I wouldn't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, because I wouldn't really enjoy it. But if I would really enjoy it.
The body's pleasures are clearly, they're very closely tied to a person's spiritual pleasures as well. This doesn't mean that just wouldn't be pleasure, and it's not even a sense of
pleasure. What if you're trying to lose weight? You are perfectly healthy in your body, but you want to be thinner and less. There's no reason for you to do that. You create a scenario where someone would give you pleasure to lose weight.
Yeah, it would be three less of owners of the Maratha.
I think
But obviously it needs to be taken into consideration with other types of pleasure as well, but, you know, it doesn't contradict the fact that God, in addition to caring about the higher forms of pleasure, also cares about the
No, I'm fine with that. I'm just saying that the notion of coercion, right, that's it, right, even if you accept that, right, that the principle that the Shulchan Aruch Rav is setting out is that you have no rights, doesn't mean that somebody else can force you to. Right? And the extreme, like, since you think you have no right to deny yourself ice cream in some circumstances, does that mean that we would think, that we would suggest that we would force you to experience, right? You know, let's say you're just scared, right? We think that it's a tremendous pleasure to ride roller coasters. And if we can only get you on the roller coaster, you'll have a great time. And I'm sufficiently confident of that to act on it. And you're just scared. Well, the heck with you. Right? Tie you up, put you on the roller coaster, right? That's a better example. There's no health risk, nothing like that. It's just that you're a coward. Right, so I will force you to experience this pleasure. Right? You're not going to eat this food because you're afraid to try new things. But I can tell you, I know you well enough. I know that you're really going to love this. So let's force it down your throat. I don't think you would say that. Pardon? No, but I think it happens more often with roller coasters than it does with food. I think it happens not infrequently in roller coasters. You know, at an emotional level. And he was jumping out of trees, you know, on zip lines. All right.
When he talks about the Mahal Mishneh, the fact that by Divrei Agadah, he's speaking about kol hana'a she'adam lo ne'ena mimena, hu chayav la'mita, and things like that. And it doesn't mean exactly Mahal Mishneh, like it doesn't so clear and defined as a soul. It speaks very widely, very broad.
נראה, לא רק אגדה זו, גם הלכה, נראה.
כן, אבל אני חושב ש... It doesn't mean exactly this, like Shulchan Aruch says in צדיק ח' about תפילה, when you, before you pray, you should be התפשטות הגשמיות and all of this. He was stating, like, כותרת, our title, and he doesn't exactly the every time don't eat. זאת אומרת, הוא לא מתכוון בדיוק שתקבע את זה עד סוף הגבולות, זה ככה אני חושב.
נראה, אני חושב שבישיר מן הגמרא על נזיר.
כן, זה גם...
ונראה שהם לוקחים את זה כעניין הלכתי ולא עניין אגדי.
כן, אבל זה דברי אגדה במקור, אבל אני חושב שזה לא מדויק, זאת אומרת, כמו כל הלכה, when you put your shoes, it should be, it's like the right first and then the left, זה יותר משהו כללי.
אהה. We'll see at the end how much you think, right, how useful that is halachically. Okay. So now we go to the Rambam in Hilchot Ratzeach Shmirat HaNefesh. Right, so here the Rambam tells you the halacha of kofir. The muzarin beit din shelo likach kofir min harasech, v'afilu natan kol mamon she ba'olam, v'afilu rata goel adam lefatro, she'ein nafsho shel zeh ha'nehra kinyan goel adam, ela kinyan ha'kadosh baruch hu. So what is it? Does this support Dr. Steinberg's thesis or not?
Does not.
Okay, explain to me why not.
I own my body, and I'm saying that God said you have to kill somebody, and therefore you have to do it. It doesn't matter that you don't want it.
Okay, so right. So the first thing you're doing, right? So let's be careful about the motive analysis. In the right, it deals with specific halakha, right? So you can always claim that the rhetoric is meaning, right? The rhetoric only comes to back up halakha and can't teach you any broader claims. That's I'm going to grant that up front. Any evidence from rhetoric, you can always claim the rhetoric only supports this specific position. All right, so I want to try and work this, but let's assume that the rhetoric can be taken to stand for broader principles. Okay, let's assume that. Right, you're right, absolutely. That's right, rhetoric is enough. But let's assume that. Even if I grant him the proposition that this rhetoric is supposed to be generalizable, does this rhetoric say what he wants it to?
It's not saying the body doesn't belong to the Osech, it's saying the body doesn't belong to the Goel Adam.
Right, which means that...
Which means that the body can still belong to the Osech. That's to the Osech.
To the...
Osech and himself. Whose body are we talking about?
Well, okay, so you can't... Well, the halacha that he's saying is you can't... The Beit Din cannot allow the Goel Adam to accept compensation, right, as a rather than carrying out the execution, which the Goel Adam is fundamentally required to carry out, but the Beit Din will carry out if the Goel Adam refuses to. Right? It says the reason for that is that the body of the killed is not the property of the, but rather the property of the of God. So now I'm asking you, that rhetoric, does that rhetoric support the claim Dr. Steinberg is making, and if not, why not?
I don't think it does,
Good, okay, find it sharply. So what does it exclude? Whose ownership does it exclude?
Someone else.
As opposed to?
His own.
Good, okay, right, that's the first stage, right? All this says is that the Goel Adam doesn't own it as much as God does. Okay, that doesn't tell you, right, you might say, okay, but he owns it himself. Well, so what? He's not there to own it anymore. Right, it doesn't tell you who owns it, right? There might have been a 90-10 partnership in which I own my body 90%, God owns it 10%, but now I'm dead. So my ownership rights revert to God. So now God owns 100% and the Goel Adam owns nothing. Right? That's on the very, all the rhetoric does is exclude the ownership of the Goel Adam. It says nothing about the ownership of the person himself. Yes, Rory.
Couldn't you also understand it then as if the person owned his own body, then by inheritance clause, the Goel Adam would have gotten the ownership?
Okay, you could defend it that way by saying that, right, that ownership of the body should be hereditary, right? I'm open to that possibility, but I also am open to it not being true, right? If Dr. Steinberg's premise depends on hereditability of bodies, right, it's not, right, right, that's not the world, it's not the world strong, but this matters, by the way, nowadays in terms of whether we believe that relatives should have a formal role to play in terms of post-mortem organ donations, right? As opposed, you might think, well, obviously relatives have a role to play because they know what the person thought best. No, of course not, right? Because, right, the obvious answer to that is no. We know what the person wanted. The person wanted to do what halacha tells them to do. And that, of course, rabbis know best. So why should relatives play any role at all, right? Obviously, right, it should just be an objective decision by a rabbi. Right, so the notion that relatives have rights over the disposal of the body is actually very relevant, and there's actually a strong evidence for that. Strong evidence for that is that the chiyuv kvura is on the relatives. Right, so while I'm being, you know, making fun of it in one sense, right, it's not really fair. Right, I think you're right that that's a premise of the position. I just don't think it's an absolute enough premise to make this evidence the other way. Okay, what else? What else serves to limit this? See, now all of you, I translate it tendentiously, right? Which all of you, right? What do you want to say, David?
Someone pointed out yesterday,
yeah.
Not show and not do both.
Very good. Yeah. So what is right? So what is it that God owns?
Your life.
God owns.
Not your body, not what you can do to your body, but it seems like your life is. It's also because this is what Solomon says later on. But it's almost like emden. You can't take your your wife doesn't belong to you, it belongs to the other person, but it belongs to God. But not anything with body and risk and health.
Good. So, right, so let's frame it this way. What is the wrong for which the murderer is punished?
Taking someone's life.
Okay, taking someone's life makes it interpersonal. Alright, so let's frame it right. Removing the nefesh from the goof. Alright? So if we frame that, right, is that a wrong to the goof? Or is that a wrong to the nefesh? If we frame it as a wrong to the goof, right, pardon? Or it could be a wrong to both, right? We have those three possibilities, right? Right, goof, nefesh, or both together. If we frame it as a wrong to the goof, then the response has to be, no, God owns the body. But if we frame it as a wrong to the nefesh, right, what you did wrong, the wrong is that you removed God's nefesh from the place where God wanted it to be. That tells you nothing whatsoever about the body. Right, the Goel Adam may own the body for all we know. He's not taking the money for the body. Right, he's taking the money for the removal of the nefesh. Right, so that the Goel Adam has nothing to do with. Even if he owns the body absolutely. Right, even if we hold that the Goel Adam can happily sell the body. right, to exhibit it in some museum or something like that. It matters not to us at all. That's what I want to. So I want to argue that you have to continually distinguish between death and other, and other issues on this. And here the language is helpful. Right, doesn't say she'en gufo. Yes.
As I understand in the Rambam terminology, it's not like a soul against the body. What makes the body to wach noal, it's not like dualism, apaton, guf, and nefesh. Nefesh is the tsura of the body.
No.
What makes the body is
the life, the life force in the Rambam is the shama. Nefesh is the immortal soul.
But if they hear the nefesh from the pasuk, and the pasuk is to velo tikhu kofo le nefesh roseach, not to the nefesh of the ne'erag.
That is
kapara.
So it's, you can't lo tikhu kofo le nefesh roseach nechashesh lo mer shelo tikhu lo tikhu kofo. So she mitchila hachiyuv hi lokacha the nefesh at Nefesh Ratzach, as Shura Pasuk, lo tikach kofer liftor at Nefesh Ratzach in Mita. Aval Aram omer shebechol zot, im lochim et ha-kofer, lochim et ha-kofer tmurat Nefesh HaNirzach.
Yeah, so why say Shenemal? It's like, suppose
that
Pasuk
will chazek
oto.
I chashev shekol ma shechashuv bepasuk zot, lo tikhu kofer lo ratzach. And yan Nefesh lo kashur. I understand the claim, but so how do you fit the line lo tichu kofel nefesh roteach with Rambam omer beferush she'en nafsho shel zeh neherag, as ma hakbala ben shel zeh neherag lenefesh roteach?
That's why I don't understand
here
in the Rambam.
Aha, okay. So ne'er so raya lo milad nefesh b'pasuk ela lu lo hayahab המילה נפש מופיע בפסוק, היה אברהם מביא אותו הראיה. הפסוק אומר, לא תיקחו כופר לרוצח.
Okay, so the nefesh is just a
clue. Yeah, זה מה שאני חושב. אני מכיר שזה בעיותי, ויהיה יותר טוב אם יהיה אפשר ליצור איזה הקשר בין המילה נפש בפסוק למילה נפש במשפט הקודם ברמב"ם. Yes,
yeah, the truth is, the first time I read it, I assumed that here, for some reason, the word neherag meant nirzach, just because I thought it made more sense that way. If we read neherag to mean...
You mean the to be killed as opposed to the has been killed.
Right, because if we read neherag to mean the person who has been killed, I'm just sort of confused as to what it would mean. Why does... Oh, it means that ownership of the soul of
is God,
who is already killed, is
God.
Is God, but...
Therefore, the Gol Adam can't accept compensation. Because
the premise is, if you own the soul, you get the discretion as to whether or not you can accept compensation.
Because the wrong was done to you.
Well, why is the wrong done to you if you own the soul?
Because the wrong that was done was the removal of the soul from the body.
So you're saying it's a wrong done to the soul, and because your ownership of the soul, now the wrong was done to you?
Yeah. Why? The wrong was done to your ox. Your ox, right? So you get
the wrong was done to somebody else's ox, and then you inherit the ox.
Yeah, then you inherit the claim.
it just seems to make a lot more sense to me if we're now talking about the future.
Especially
if you read Nefesh, then it's not talking about souls, and then you find yourself in some sort of, you know, metaphysical debate as to whether or not, like, you're wronging the soul or the body by removing the soul from the body. It just means life. Right? Nefesh is right. Your life is forfeit.
I can't prove it. You know, my feeling is that it should say that Haneherag, when he hasn't yet been killed, that's the whole issue. Right? It is hard.
I hear you totally, and I understand that the word Neherag is also used before to talk about the actual Neherag,
yeah.
But I just can't shake the feeling that the word should be near, you know, the word should be Rotzeach.
It should be near Tach, right? You're saying that you want to read it as the Rotzeach because it doesn't say near Tach.
Right, exactly. You know, even the Nirzach was referred to as the Neherag earlier.
Okay, I understand the point. It goes together with Adi's point. I'm not convinced, but I don't have a disproof. It just feels, it, you know, it just doesn't feel right to me. So that's, you know, I can't. That has to be your judgment call. Yes, Rav.
Yeah, I'm just
I was just wondering, I find the point that we were making a clear distinction between Kinyan and Hashem having Kinyan and Nefesh versus Kinyan and the Guf. What I wonder is, if there was such a concept of people have Hashem having a Kinyan on the Guf, then would that appear, say, in the Isurim of tattooing or Parachat and these sorts of things? Do we have examples of that?
That's interesting. I only have the rhetoric that is cited by the people in the article on this subject.
Right.
Nobody, to my knowledge, has brought up. All the cases that are cited are in the packet.
Okay.
And I think that's the.
Is it worth maybe going through the?
Worth looking and seeing if anybody came up with it. But yes, as far as I know, there is a whole notion of, by tattooing, people talk about the notion of, God gave you a body, you shouldn't mess it up, but
right.
That.
Right, it's a colloquial term, but I'm wondering.
Right, that runs into Rabbi Akiva and the wheat, and us eating bread, right, and Mila. Right, the fact that we do Mila, right, which we then defend by saying that God gave us perfectible bodies, so anybody, so as long as you see his tattoos as aesthetic as opposed to as destructive, then the whole argument falls apart.
Right.
Right, so I don't think it's a very good treatment of, a very good explanation of tattooing. You can try and assimilate the prohibition of being, the karchot karcha,
yeah.
All right, or what it's good to do, on that, but then you just assimilate them to chavala ba'atzmecha, and actually we'll see that some of the evidence that chavala ba'atzmecha is mutar is if it were us, or who would need a prohibition, rather of being the karech elamet.
Oh.
Right, so it goes both ways. Yes, there is.
Do you think there's an issue of
cremation? Do I think there is an issue of cremation as opposed to a bitul chiyav kvura?
As opposed to, chiyav kvura it can either be kavod hamet or it's bizayon hamet not to.
Right.
Right. So if it's kavod hamet, the mate can be mofel. And
maybe.
If you're in a society.
Not so clear. Not every kind of kavod can be nimchal. We'll talk about that in a moment.
And if it's bizayon hamet, so if you're in a society where cremation is a honorable way of treating a dead body. It's not a denial. There should be no, if the dead person says this is what he wants, there should be no real issue of cremation. Unless you're willing to hold that it's not his body.
Or unless you hold it as a chiyuv kvura, which isn't based on kavod, which is based on some metaphysical notion that either kiyafara talvi lafar tashuv, or it might be the halakha decided to be koveya absolutely a principle, even though in some societies cremation. I understand you can construct a theoretical philosophic defense of cremation. I don't know that necessarily has to translate.
I think that's
an opinion of the shadow. Why don't we just use autopsies, right, which we will. We're going to get to autopsies in 2 weeks. I think it's better than cremation. Right? Can you allow autopsies and organ donations? Cremation.
But that sometimes pikuach nefesh, and pikuach nefesh can override a lot of things. It's never pikuach nefesh.
Let's say it's not pikuach nefesh. If it's pikuach nefesh, you shouldn't need permission. Right? So I think if after that you still think cremation is a better test case, then we can talk about that. I think if there are all sorts of results, like kilat lakim talui, there's gefar tavi lafar tashuv, right, there's a whole bunch of issues. If we wanted to do kvura per se, we'd do it. I'd rather deal with it in the autopsy context, and if it turns out that cremation needs to be discussed, then that's not right. That's fine too. Okay. So then I gave them over to Vukim just.
I was wondering regarding the Rotsaf in general.
Yeah.
He has a responsibility to go after the person who killed his brother or whatever.
Yeah, the Galadon, yeah.
What gives him that responsibility? Usually when we talk about having responsibility for something, it's also a partnership with ownership, like in a marriage or something like that. So
it's
what gives them responsibility?
Some notion of ownership. That relatives have some notion of ownership. I think you can construct the theory that all relatives own, the notion of geula by property seems to imply that, that families own property together. At least land is owned together that way. We always talk about yibum. I think you have to talk about it in terms of ownership. You can talk about it the way Professor Levinson does, that there's a notion of corporate identity, right? And it's, right, it's not that I own you. It's that, in some sense, all members of the family really are part of one another. I think that's certainly possible to construct. I don't know that it's true, but it's possible. Right, because you might, what's the halamina that the nefesh of the nerag is the kinyan, if the kinyan goel adam? Right, so right, the fact is, halamina seems to imply something of the sort. Absolutely. Okay, then I gave you the Mordechim, and the whole point of the Mordechim was to point out the Rambam doesn't say this in the Mordechim. Right, the Mordechim, he says it perfectly, he says it's because ein adam esim atzmo, in the Mordechim he says it's because this is a really bad sin. And he leaves out this whole rhetoric. So how seriously to take this rhetoric, right, when in other places the Rambam is perfectly conventional, leaving it out, I leave it to you.
Yeah.
You thought that?
I thought the first rhetoric is for you. Usually the Rambam uses that as
yourself.
This is a really bad thing to do.
Yeah. Maybe this is just a window dressing thing, you know? Murder is really, really bad. Why? Because you're killing something of God's. And that's all it means. Right? And everyone agrees that there's some notion in which the Adam is Kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? Here's an easy example where, right, who can give me the pasuk which proves that Kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't have Kinyanim? Batomer, Kaniti Yishet Hashem. Right? So there's a classic example, right? God has a Kinyan, but I have a Kinyan too. Right, it doesn't exclude a partnership. Who is the controlling partner? Lo yada. Now we could argue that was a chait, right? And really, it was not. It shouldn't have been kneti yitzir Hashem. We get the whole discussion, right, over what the meaning of Chava's naming of Kain is. But prima facie, I don't know. I don't think that rhetoric has to mean anything. Okay, then we get to the Rambam. We're not trying to prove the halachic perspective. We're trying to prove his philosophic perspective. Right, there's no nafkamina halacha. You can't take kofir. Right, yes.
I mean, I guess there's also room to say though that because what immediately precedes the underlying reading, you think about grouping as like you go, maybe you go one, you take one, no, yes, la, 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 kel. Or you could say that in the case that seems to promote a conception where basically everything besides the actual life of a murderer is like a tradable commodity and something that is.
So we could push it out of the other. It's true that really it's only the nefesh and the goof is fine.
Right.
Because we take kofir for Kabbalah. Why do we take kofir for Kabbalah? Right. So it might be, but that proves that if we argue that the inability to take kofir demonstrates that the nefesh is not, then the ability to take kofir Kabbalah proves that the goof is.
The Rambam says that from Qudos Homepra, it should only be ayin ha'atayin.
Right, but we allow you to take kofir. Obviously, it's your right. I guess
he doesn't know what to do with that. He's just that's how the Gemara learns it.
If I wished to write an article in which the assignment was, make it right, come up with a philosophic argument on the question of whether God right of whether human beings have any ownership rights in their body from the following text, I might find it easier to write the argument from these texts showing that human beings do them as they don't. But I wouldn't. I'm not prepared to say informed consent is critical because you own your body. Because look, the Rambam allows right. The Rambam says that the reason you don't take kofir for murder is that you don't own your body. Mashma that the fact that you do take kofir chavala means you do own your body. That seems a long way to go from the evidence we have. But I think it's at least as plausible as the reverse. I think that it just tells you that you can't prove anything from this. It's rhetoric. Okay, now we get to the Rambam Hilchos Sanhedrin. So the Rambam Hilchos Sanhedrin. So let's see. Were you up to this?
I'd like to get this back.
Yeah. Good. So, in your understanding, according to the Rambam, why don't you execute people who confess? Good.
Was that you don't, the person can't bear witness against himself because he's the closest person to himself.
Does the Rambam mention that here?
Is it in this one or not in this one?
Don't think so, right? No, I don't. It doesn't mention that here.
And then the other one was that.
Well, so take a look at the text, right? In the text, right? What does the Rambam say? Sanhedrin neither executes nor whips confess, right, people who confess. Why? Right, what does he say in the next three lines?
Oh, because they might have a death wish.
That's, I think, Pashat Pshat in the Rambam. You don't do this because they might have a death wish. Right? Meaning that what's right? Meaning what? That they might actually. They might actually be lying. Okay, so they might be lying, and what's wrong with that? So right, so they lied because they wanted they wanted you to kill them, and you killed them. So what went wrong? So that implies, that assumes that you that this is wrong. Right, it's wrong to kill people even if they want to be killed.
But again, it's not wrong.
It's
right. At the very least, it's a perversion of justice, right? make an argument to say that if somebody wants to be killed, they can be killed, but they shouldn't take advantage of the judicial system to do it because that sort of makes a mockery of the system.
It's a problem for judicial economy. There could be real court cases to try.
Now, you should be aware, by the way, that this is a...
Another bad expression. Right.
Up front, we should say that this is... You should be aware this is a real phenomenon. Right? That any time there is a public murder, there is a raft of false confessions. Right? And the police are fully aware of this. There's a raft of... Right? Whether it's because they want to be executed, right? You know, I don't know if there are any studies showing whether that the number of confessions diminishes when you take away the death penalty or not. But this is a real phenomenon. People do confess falsely, especially to capital, right? To serious crimes. The Radbaz builds on this, right? And the Radbaz makes the claim that this is built on the same notion as what we saw in terms of the Kofar, that the human being is God, and therefore you have no right to confess so as to cause your own death. Now that's a very peculiar notion. What's the easiest proof that this is? I mean, I would say the proof for this is an absurd argument. Well, okay. Let's grant that this is plausible in the Rambam. Okay, let's grant that for now. Right? You're right. Let's grant that this is plausible in the Rambam. Then we could read this way around. We ought to say, no, this is an absurd argument, right? What's the easiest proof this is an absurd argument?
The third box?
Yeah.
But Malkoth.
Okay, we can tell the Malkoth. That I think is a weakness. But it's just a way. But just make it. It's just prima facie. It doesn't get started. Yes, John.
I mean, the classic case of egos is you clearly don't own the person that you're testifying.
Absolutely right. You don't own other people either. Right, you can testify to get other people executed. Why? Because they're supposed to get executed. They did something wrong. So why are you different than anybody else? Right? This is just absurd. Right, if you look at it that way, yes, dude.
The Torah told you you're supposed to listen to him.
Good. So the Torah told you you're supposed to confess. Right? Well, Torah doesn't tell you told you're supposed to say it.
So God said, this is how you're supposed to deal with my property. Kill it if Adam testified about this.
Right.
That doesn't mean you.
What about what gives me the right to be an aid?
The Torah.
Good. So I'm being an aid.
You're one aid.
You'll
kill people on
one aid. No, that's Baldin Kamehade and them. Right, that's the whole issue, right?
Right, but we have a Chashash Mishaker here.
No, I understand. But the Radbaz says that the reason we don't accept your confession is that you're not allowed to confess because since God owns your body, you can't be the cause of your body's
death.
That's
not how I understood the Radbaz.
Let's go back and look at it then. Right? So the Rambam says, "The Shalat Text Tatam, Lefisha Ein Nafsho Shel Adam Kineneu Le Kinyan Kadosh Baruch Hu, Right? Shneamar Nafashot Lihena, Hilchach Lo Toil Ho Da'ato B'Davar Sheino Shelo.
Toil.
Because it's not his, therefore it won't help.
It won't help the fact that you want to give up your life is not sufficient cause for the Beit Din to kill you, because the Beit Din because the Beit Din needs believable aidas to kill you, and we have a chashash for shocker that maybe you're lying.
No.
No.
No, the Tehechid ain't a dumb Rashai LaHarog
Et Atzmo. I think David has a point, and I think he went too far. It's not saying that we're saying you, if you want to end your life and therefore admitting to it, that doesn't help us.
Right.
But Adim don't want to. Adim just saw the thing. It's not that, you know, you can't use the court to end your life, basically what he's saying. Because it's not really your life.
Is David saying that? I thought David, right, do you understand? Let's read the whole thing together again. Okay, v'efsharlat ksatam l'fish ein nafsho shel adam kinyanu l'kinyan kadosh baruch hu shenemar nafsho lihena hilchach lo tu'il hadu ato b'davar she'ena shelo u'malkot palgu d'mitahu aval mamona hu shelo, but money is yours. Now tell me when I go wrong. Okay, but the money is yours. U'mishum hachi, and because the money is yours, therefore we say hoda'at baldin kemei edim dame, therefore we treat your testimony as the equivalent of 100 witnesses, and you're saying not in terms of credibility, but in terms of legal effect. Right? Okay, right. V'chihechi de'en adam rashai laharog ad atzmo, and just like a person is not permitted to kill himself, now where, how do you explain that? Shouldn't it be...
You have, I mean, so, think like the Ketosan Kodat Baldin Kamei Adami. You are believed for anything which impacts only yourself.
Right.
So when you testify about your money, that affects only you.
Good.
Your belief. When you testify about your body isn't yours. It affects God, who is not you. So you're not believed.
So if the Rabbah said the following, "V'chihechi din adam rashai l'harog et atzmo." Kain ein ma'aminim adam ha'model atzmo. That would be fine. He doesn't frame it as the courts can't believe you. He frames it as you're not allowed to testify.
Okay. Right.
Yes. Okay. You did it, then Ron.
So I think the issue is here that there's a big difference between hoda'ah and edut. The issue is not right. He's not making you can't make the comparison saying you can't be me'id on somebody else because you don't own them. You can't be mo'deh on somebody else because you don't own them. That's true. Because hoda'at baal din kemeah edim damu, but not edut baal din kemeah. So basically you're saying, right, here, in another case you would be saying, well, you're being mo'deh that you owe $100 or $1,000. You're
right.
Saying you're being mo'deh that you owe your life.
Right.
Right? So because you can be mo'deh that you owe $100 or $1,000 because that's yours. You can't be mo'deh on your life because you don't own your life. He's just
right.
Viewing it as the extension of the...
That's right. But why? Why can't I be moda? What's wrong? What is wrong with being moda? It's the consequence. I can't do the thing that... Right, I can't be moda because if I'm moda, that would cause.
No, you think you just can't be moda that you owe something that's not yours. You can't be, right, you can't agree voluntarily to give up something that's not yours.
I can't be moda that I owe... $100 of Daniel.
So is it, again, is it that we don't believe you?
No, it's not that we don't believe you. It's that you...
I'm not permitted.
Hoda doesn't work. It just doesn't work for something that's not yours.
But he doesn't say it doesn't work. He says it's not permitted.
I think you're making that your comment.
I'm not sure what the difference is.
Is the same language we use for this for other people that can't serve as witnesses?
I don't think so. Nobody claims us or to testify.
Right.
Okay. I do.
I mean, I'm not sure.
What doesn't work? You can't do that. It's against the rules of the game. The game is
exactly
the
how
system. You have certain rules that you're allowed to take. That's just not a legal rule.
Yeah, I think that's how I read. But if even the other way, would the other way that work?
No. Well, that's a matter of permission. Isn't there some sort of any sewer? It's
inherently prohibited on you. In theory, you have the capacity to do so. Hell, I've been not allowing you to be
okay.
Not that there's no capacity.
No. No. It says we don't listen. It's not a prohibition against you for coming. It's right, we just don't listen. Yes, ma'am.
I think the Rambam can answer a question in simple way, I don't agree with you, but they can tell you it's one Zerah, a whole Zerah, they can do. But Chala, no one can testify another else. And this is more chidush, that two Edim, Shnei Edim, can testify another else.
Aha, so the Rav is going to claim that the Chiddush is other people's testimony. Right, so the capacity to give Edim is a Matir, so the Yisr of Ritzicha, and the absence of an explicit Matir by Azad Saldin, because it says, Al Pishnayim Edim O Shlosha Edim Yakum Davar. So the point of that is a Chiddush that Shnei Edim are allowed to testify, but right, that leaves everybody else. He's sort of a common medic.
I don't think the kasha from the two areas with Mokra, which
is. Aha, interesting.
I was just saying,
I was thinking the same way. I suppose to me the issue is like I see that as a real kiddush. So the notion of bringing a raya, the other way, is strange to me.
How's that? It's a big kiddush that two Adim is a kiddush.
It's a big kiddush that. Testifying, to me it's a big chiddush to say that you need a heter to be allowed to testify to something that's sort of criminalized.
I think it's a pretty tough
okay.
I've seen it before.
No, I think it's a chiddush that we can kill people, but the notion that criminal edus bichlal requires a heter. Right? That's it's not impossible. It's
Bishop Lashon Hara.
Right, so Lashon Hara, right, so right, we did last, right, you might argue, right, because the answer is Lashon Hara to start with.
Or the answer is just this, again, you don't have a right to go and try to kill God's body. What can you do? The Torah makes the Xerxes Kutzim, the two Adam can come do that.
Yeah, but why would they do
the Kutzim? To me, you're not trying to kill them, you're trying to help Beit Din do his job.
But
it's
linked to killing
them. You're smart with it.
That's,
I care what everybody
you have a, you have a, an a, everyone has an a priori fear to help Beit Din do its job. Right, that's the way I would start. But okay, I'm motivated. You can reverse it. Jonathan, what do you want to say?
When we're framing the Rambam, before we get to the Rambam, you want to frame the Rambam,
uh-huh.
Right? Meaning the Rambam's fundamental argument is not the death wish argument, right? It's the end of the day, it's the capping of political leverage there. It's a cause of those.
Right.
Right. Besides for this Rambam, right, the Rambam in two other places, right, Dafka Eidus, that's the way he frames it, right, and you saw the Atar Zayin Gimel and Chesed, he both assumes in both of those places, right, that the notion of Eidus is Xeris Hakasso, right, we have no reason to believe it whatsoever, right, so, and that's the way he ends up framing it here, right, and the thrust of the Rambam's argument is not this middle piece at all. I mean, that's his, you know, so to speak, how many amitzvahs was coming in. But in terms of actually framing, right, just the legal argument he's making, it seems that his fundamental argument is Xeris HaKasev. And if he only said this and said closer to Xeris HaKasev, and I didn't know that at least in two other places the Rambam feels compelled to present Eidos as Xeris HaKasev, right, that doesn't make any sense,
yeah.
Right, I might say that argument has more weight in the Rambam. But in the Rambam, it seems to me that it really is here. So
okay, fine, but I'm not even addressing the question whether Radbaz is related to the Rambam yet.
Right, and then, right, but that's in the Rambam. Then once we get to the Radbaz, if he has any notion of relationship to the Rambam, right,
yeah.
To the Rambam, right, before we even get started, the argument, first of all, is weaker because it's not, right, he is giving, once you're dealing with, you know, he's not trying to make a fundamentally legal argument, and the Radbaz himself, right, says, and at the end of the day, I agree with the Rambam that Kol Shel Davar Xeris HaKasev Hu, which, whatever we assume the Radbaz means at the end of the day, it has to be, right, taken with a grain of salt, because he knows that he's going to come back to Kol Shel Davar Xeris HaKasev Hu, and whatever he says has an actual, you know, he's not attempting to have any legal import.
This is true, although you could argue that he thinks of Kol Shel, right, that in the end he thinks that that rationale is not a sufficient explanation of this halakha. But
right,
he still, but in principle, he accepts that he's not questioning. He said, "Kol Shel Davar Xeris HaKasev," is not that he questions the theology. He just questions whether theology generates this legal
right. I'm just pointing out that the seriousness you have to give to an argument that someone gives when he knows it's going to have absolutely no implications, right, is not as strong as one where he's actually.
Sure, I'm willing to grant that. I'm willing to grant that. But I'm interested in the other conversation where you start, right, where you do you guys want to, which I guess do you want to start with the notion that even if I'm guilty, I suppose like usually what how small does one take the position that I am guilty and I know that I am guilty but I'm not allowed to aid the court in carrying out. Part of the issue is, do I have a chiyuv to resist the executioner on the grounds of a suicide? I don't think so. Oh, yes, Mish.
So we're assuming that if this guy goes and he admits that he himself did a sin which incurs the death penalty,
right,
there are really only a couple potential reasons to he's doing that for the sake of, just he wants to commit suicide, but his sin is already in a bear. Right? The other option, which we saw before, is that he's doing it out of kapara. So maybe the reason where he is not allowed to testify against himself, whereas others can testify against him, is because he has the alternative of tshuva for kapara. Now he can just, if he's saying, I want kapara, Hashem says, no, I own your body, you're going to need to find a way to have kapara while at the same time keeping your body. But another witness testifying against him has no free will to be able to force this guy to do tshuva, because tshuva is something internal. So and one of the main reasons, if not the essential reason, for the death penalty in general is a kapara for the soul who committed that sin. So that could be the essential difference.
Yeah, so you have
we want there to be a kapara for the person, but only the guy who has done the sin has that as a live option, whereas witnesses don't have that.
So the guy has it as a live option.
Everybody does. Tshuva is always an option.
No.
Tshuva isn't necessarily sufficient for kapara.
Exactly. There's some
Tshuva
which only meets a sufficient kapara.
He's going to die eventually, anyway.
And Yom Kippur, and doing tshuva. And then,
what if he wants his kapara sooner?
Okay, and that's what Hashem's saying. Exactly. Okay. Hashem's saying, no, you can't do that.
That I think is a clever and even beautiful rationale. I'm not sure it requires you to believe that you don't own your body, though.
Why not?
Because it might be that
Hashem owns everything. And like here, too, he's saying you don't have the right to die prematurely. You're going to need to do tshuva the hard way.
The fact that God has
restrictions
on what I can do with my body doesn't mean I don't own it. God has restrictions on what I can do with any of my property.
As I would still argue, that the fact that other people can testify means that you can cause the death of somebody even if you don't own them. And I don't even argue, but under what circumstances can you cause the death of something you own? The answer may be, well, only when necessary. Right, but the fact that I can, that I, but right, but the, it can't, the reason I can't, the argument, the only reason I can't testify is because I don't own it. You're arguing the reason I can't testify is because there's something better I should do.
Yes.
Right, so you might argue, well, why do I have to do the better thing? Okay, maybe because I'm doing something wrong if I kill the body. Right, that's what generates the obligation to do the best possible thing. Okay, I don't have that. I think it's elaborate again to make this a raya, but I think that's a very pretty explanation.
I don't think so.
I think it's a good explanation of why you can't testify. I think that's very good. The connection to that, between that and owning your body, seems to me elaborate.
I was connecting it more even to the why witnesses can testify.
Yes. No, I think that's good. I think it's a freestanding rationale that doesn't really connect to the owning your body, not owning body axis. And it's right. That's what I want to argue. That you can say that at the end of that, you say, okay, so who needs the owning your body, not owning your own body, right? It's just right. Why should you cause a death when you don't have to?
Hashem wants to. And that doesn't need a rational explanation. Doing tshuva in the first place is going back to what Hashem wants.
Yeah.
Versus what Hashem doesn't want. So you can't do tshuva while it's like dipping in the mikvah while holding a rest.
Okay. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Again, I just don't think that requires you to believe that you don't own your body. That's all. to say that the reason you can't testify is because you should do tshuva instead, you can say that without believing you don't own your body.
Without
believing you don't own your body.
Meaning believing that you do own your body.
You can believe you do own your body, and nonetheless, you still can't, right? You still can't, right? Get yourself killed as opposed to doing tshuva. It's not such. I don't think it's so connected. Okay, but I think the explanation is really good, and maybe some of you will think that it's legitimate if you think that undermines my kasha and makes the red buzz respectable. But I think that's a legitimate outcome. Okay, interesting. I don't read it the way David did, but I guess I do focus on the word rashai. I think that Rav Zevin really focuses on the word rashai, so I think I'm getting it from him. Right, he's gonna say, right. So we'll have to take a look at that and see if I'm right.
I mean, I like Kyle's reading for Shai, like a chess game. It's an illegal move. It's not here.
Can fight it out at the end of the summer again. I don't think so, but we can fight it out. Now it turns out whether this is the Rambam or not. So I think there's a much simpler explanation of the Rambam, which is. Right, you know, I think it's like really, I tend to think that the fact that the Rambam feels compelled to mention the possibility that it's a death wish tells you he doesn't believe this at all. It's fakir. If this is what the Rambam thought, then the whole issue of a death wish is irrelevant. Right, so I think the Rambam is just pushers saying that, you know what, if you allow confessions, you're gonna, right, confessions are simply unreliable, that's it. But on the other hand, he's telling you, you know, and I think that Jonathan's right, he's telling you, but you know what, all testimony is unreliable. So in the end, we have to set arbitrary boundaries as to what kind of testimony, right, what kind of risk we're willing to take. Right? We know there are risks. There are risks in eyewitness identification also. Right? I like Perry Mason. All the eyewitnesses always have it wrong and they're easily confused. All that kind of stuff. You shouldn't, right? So the notion that we accept anything as true is, right, it's a chiddush. But it seems to be much more pashut than the Rambam to say that he tells you, right, that guess what? First of all, some of these people are insane, and they have a death wish, and you shouldn't execute these people. So if confessions have no weight in capital cases. And then the connection, the argument that, you know, I don't understand why to make the claim that he only puts in the Xeris HaKasav because of the Malkos issue. Right, and but he thought that it might work for Malkos also because he says in one place Malkos Abimukam Misa. That seems like wildly elaborate to me also. But why don't you just say that, guess what, just like some people do things confess in order to get themselves killed, some people confess in order to get themselves flogged. Right, that's all. Because they think they deserve it. Right, because they think that the more kapara they get, that gives them the capacity to do sins in advance. I don't know. Right? You know, what happens if you get Malkos unjustifiably? Does that mean you can go commit one Isur Karis? Indulgences? I don't know. It has a certain appeal. I think that's much more fluffy. Okay, Tony did not. Someone had a hand up here.
Yeah. I was just going to jump on the fact that we talked about self-incriminating evidence.
Right.
We have a system of balance within the court system in the sense of witnesses, of the ability to bring in like agents, omens, and things like that. With your own self-incriminating evidence, I mean, either way, you're gonna lose. Like, if you're testifying against yourself that you killed somebody, and
yeah,
then somebody comes and proves that you didn't do it,
in that sense. Right. We can also claim that, right, what?
I think what Roy's trying to say is that through Drisha and Chakira, we would figure out whether or not this was legitimate aid.
Right, so we could investigate, right?
What I'm saying, though, is that I'm saying, actually, that he can be an aid zomim on himself, and that in the end, he ends up getting killed either way, so clearly, what's the balance? You're gonna, like, we have this
okay, so I'll give you a technical term, right?
Right.
You can't really turn into Hazama because you can't undo the consequences of what you're saying. So the same consequence will happen if he's supposed to be Hazama as otherwise. That's clever. Right, that's really clever.
How do you all miss that?
Pardon?
How did we all do that?
Brilliant!
I like this. It's very clever. And I think you also argue, right, you know, that Adamus may seem as no Rasha can function in that way, that if you believe him, then he was postulated. Because he was a murderer. Right? So right, you could... Right, so you can play the...
you don't establish Plato's only from after...
Only from after he's established as opposed to the time of the time of the action, yes. Okay. I think I would rely on the Rambam. The notion that this is what the Rambam intends seems to me... The Rambam really says what he intends. I don't know what the problem is with him saying it. He says some version of either an insanity issue... Right, or an unreliability issue. And then he says, but you know what? But often confessions are true, so standards of evidence are always arbitrary. And all standards of evidence end up being Zeret HaKetuv. That seems to be a much simpler...
It seems that they wouldn't know what
the standards of evidence are. Right. Yeah, I think that's the... But my perspective that the Rambam is not part of this conversation, but the Rabbaz's explanation of the Rambam is part of this conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you say it's just total arbitrary? You could say that, you know, confessions are accepted by financial feelings, you know, no.
Right.
Like, that makes sense, because that there's something in that makes sense. I don't mean to say it's totally arbitrary. I'm not comfortable with it.
No, but drawing the line is arbitrary. Right, what we decide to accept as testimony and whatnot, so you know, so do we draw the line at 30%, 60%, 90%? Right, this is a natural. The way I usually frame this in classes, just to make you recognize, is the notion of beyond a reasonable doubt. Right, beyond a reasonable doubt is a very vague standard. Right, and at some point it becomes arbitrary, and more to the point, you discover that in real life, of course, beyond a reasonable doubt means something entirely different in capital cases as it does in small claims court.
Well, standard isn't in criminal, but
even in like minor drug cases, right? In capital cases, you don't set beyond a reasonable doubt to a civil case of different standards. But the same term applies to all criminal cases, and yet, in practice, of course, you shouldn't kill people on the basis of the same evidence that you would put them in jail overnight. Right? You understand, right? That at some point you have to draw fundamentally arbitrary lines. And you have to have rules at some point, and right, even though the rules will always lead to,
I don't know what you said was arbitrary. I mean,
you draw the line. You can't say this is true, right? You can't say this is true and this is false, right? There is always going to be any formal rule will exclude some testimony that is more likely to be true than other testimony. That's just you have to draw lines. Okay. Now we went to the Kolmvasser then. So the Kolmvasser, we started by just having some fun, right? So he points out that, right? So he tells you that the Radbaz begins, right? And right now the Radbaz begins with a Breita that he thinks doesn't exist, right? And it's important to the Radbaz, right? That this Breita, right? The Radbaz begins with the premise that, right? So the Radbaz begins. Why am I missing the Radbaz? Here we go. They're bothering the premise. Misha bala beitin v'amar hilkuni ein malkinoto. Right. So the Rabbaz works on that premise. So his whole goal is working off that breita. So the Kolmvasser says he can't find that. Right. He can't find that breita. But we pointed out, but the breita is in the Tshuvot of Natra Nayagon. Right, the Kolmvasser only had the Reni Rucham, but it is in the Tshuva Rav Natra. Pardon? It's the Tshuva of Natra Nayagon, and in the Tshuva of Natra Nayagon, we discover that not only is that the Breita exists, but the Breita exists with an addendum which the Rabbaz didn't have. Right, which says that while we do not have to give somebody Malkos, we are willing to give somebody Malkos. Okay, right. So where's Natra Nayagon have this breita from? Well, Natra Nayagon, it's not a breita. Right.
The Radbaz is not Meshuvah, never Tshuvas HaGaonim.
No, he's not. But that's what he's quoting, Lechora. He's quoting it, and
he
the.
Says, If he says Tanya, that implies we're talking about
a
Tanya
Inika. Yeah, it does seem to imply that.
That's far more authoritative than Shubha Saga. Oh,
this is true. But he only has, right, the only statement he has is Misha Labala Beitin Ve'amar Hilkuni Ein Malkinoto. Right, which straightforwardly seems, right, it doesn't even involve a confession. It's just somebody comes to Bezdin and says, I want to be whipped. Right, we don't do it, that's all it says. Right, but the Rebbeinu, right, now the Rebbeinu Rukam, which the Kol Vasar is a site, says you come and you confess. I'm willing to accept the likelihood that the Rebbeinu Rukam means the same thing as Radbaz, but the Rebbeinu Rukam already himself has this line, right? Avlim Ratala So Tshuva Malkino Tovo Sinlo Kapara Vezuhi Kaparato. Right, now we discover in the Gaonim that there are two versions of this Tshuva, one of which has the part about, right, one of which has the part about whipping him for tshuva, and one of which doesn't. Seems that the Radbaz may have had the version of the tshuva, which did not include the line that says you're allowed to whip him for whip him for the sake of tshuva. Right, the Radbaz just has a blanket statement. If he comes to Bezdin and says Alkuni ein Malkinoto, and he derives from that you're not allowed to confess to your own harm. But the text of the tshuva that we have, right, the full text of the tshuva, Rabbeinu Rucham and Rav Nachman Aigon, say that, but that only means that Beit Din doesn't have to accept your testimony. But obviously, there was nothing wrong with your testifying, because if you insist, if we say we don't want to whip you, we don't have to whip you, and you say, but no, I want you to, we say, okay, good, right? So that changes the whole meaning of it. And if you take a look, you'll see that the footnotes in the Yotzer HaGaonim say that the tshuva of Nachman Aigon exists in both versions. In some versions, the third piece, which says that we do it for tshuva, exists. In other versions, it doesn't. So it seems certainly plausible that the Radbaz, that the text in front of the Radbaz implied that we never give you Malkos on the basis of your own testimony, but the original text, which seems much more likely to be accurate here, right, because it's much more likely that a line fell out than that somebody made up this line. The original text was that, in fact, right, that the text which the Radbaz is built off actually implies that we do give you Malkos if you ask, as opposed to simply, we don't give it to you because we're not required to give it to you because you confess, but we're allowed to give it to you on the basis of confession. If we're allowed to give it to you on the basis of confession, then it obviously you were allowed to confess, and that means that there is no prohibition against testifying to the damage of your own body. And this actually, right, and the source of the Radbaz militates against the theory of the Radbaz. That's what I wanted to set that up. Right, the Radbaz's theory is based on the premise that you don't own your body, and because you don't own your body, therefore you can't do anything which will cause your body to be damaged. Or you want to argue that we can give no credence to an argument, right, the testimony that's against your interest. But it turns out that the Radbaz's source says that now, right, that we can go ahead and whip you as long as you're agreeable. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, but the whipping is giving you kapara, so that's not causing damage.
It's a good thing no matter what. Whether you agree to it or not, it's a good thing. It gives you kapara.
No, it only gives you kapara if you're actually five kapara.
Right. So if it's true, so why shouldn't we accept it? Only because it might not be true? That has nothing to do with ownership anymore.
No, that's a very specific case of giving you malchus in the case where you're five kapara. Giving you, it has no bearing on the death penalty. It has no bearing on giving you malchus when you're chayav only malchus.
Why should they give you the death penalty? If kapara is a good thing, then we should give you misa.
Misa you're going to get anyway.
So you're assuming that misa's bezin is never necessary for kapara.
Yeah.
See, that kind of, people were fond in the 19th century of making sure that they got all dalad misa's bezin after death, because they thought that misa's bezin really was mechaper, and misa being mechaper is much less reliable than misa's bezin. Because, right, I think that the notion that all death is mechaper, and therefore Mises Bezdin is really just jumping the gun, and you want early kapara, I don't think that's muskam. That would be right. Although I know the Mishnah idea, but I don't think that people would be, otherwise why would we tell you to throw rocks at your own?
Symbolic.
No, people really want the kapara and burn the oven.
It's
all right.
Someone is in Nidoi that we do that.
No, everyone always left instructions that they wanted that to be done because they wanted kapara.
I think it's very piety,
And even
right,
people who don't leave instructions, we still like put the stones on the gravestone.
Maybe for that, I don't know. Most people don't understand the thing about that, I think. At least they don't explain that now in America, that that's not very PC. we're putting it right, Jews have a minhag of, don't, right, right. Doesn't work so well. Yeah, sorry. That's right, because they can't, because Beit Din can't enforce Malkos because of confession.
They can, so they can only give Malkos if you say, I want Malkos, then they have the option to give you Malkos.
Right. But to me, that obviously, that takes it clearly out of the realm of right, ownership of your body.
Because
you can say, give me Malkos, and we give you Malkos. The only, right, it's just, right, that's fine.
Right, but that doesn't affect testimony then.
That's right. It means, right, it means that
you can't testify against yourself, you can just ask for Malkos.
That's right. So the reason you can't testify yourself is unrelated to ownership of the body. That's my point. Because ownership, right, because if it's ownership of the body, then Kal Vachomer, you shouldn't be able to say, give me Malkos.
No, you can, because even though God owns your body, this is beneficial. Zachin Adam Shalom Afanov. Zachin Lachai Shbarach Shalom
Afanov. All right. What conception of God are you working on?
It may be. That's fine, but you can't claim the reason you can't testify against yourself is because you don't own your body.
Okay.
Right, that's my point. So, right, you can't prove that you don't own your body from the fact that you can't testify against yourself if you can get the exact same result by just saying, and I want the punishment.
Right. You can't prove one way or another.
Yeah, I'm not proving, right. But, well, I don't know how you can prove you own your body, but, you can, but it gets you a long way if you can get people to beat you up for your religious benefit. Right. That creates a wide realm of discretion, let's put it that way. I think. But at the very least, it's not evidence for the proposition that you don't own your body. Right. If I can walk in and say, I did this crime, whip me, and nobody objects to that, and we do it, then I think that even if the Radbaz were to make sense, and even if even if you think the Radbaz makes sense, it's built on a wrong text. It's built on a wrong text. His own text, right? His own text said that, right? Says the exact opposite of the Svara, if that's the case. So I'm not willing to build anything off the Radbaz. Okay, last thing. Last thing was, having gotten into this issue, so I gave you the second last thing, right? I gave you the Mari Beirav and the Rabach, who had this fun controversy. But I want to point out, unfortunately, we don't have time to do this fascinating historical event in depth, so the whole notion of the Kiddush HaSmicha and the revival of it and all those sort of it's tremendous amount of fun. I can't resist mentioning, I remember we did this in Shira, like the best line in all of rabbinic literature occurs in this controversy, which is when the Mari Beirav comes up with the idea that you only need one samuch to give smicha in the future, because he only got universal agreement about himself. So, but you need a bez din, so you need to have two other people who don't have smicha on the bez din. But shouldn't you require smicha to give smicha? The answer is no, because there's really the das of the samuch expands to cover all the other people in the bez din, so they're just bustled to him. So it ends up, right, that there's a bez din, but it's really only one mind. And the Rabbah looks at this. I remember Yitzi Blau was supposed to read this out loud in Rosenzweig's shirt, and he just looked at Rosenzweig and said, is it mutter to read this? Because the Rabbah's line is, so let's see, we have three persons, so one mind. Which religion? Just for that, the whole controversy is worth it. Just for that. But what matters for it, it's worth putting on the Makoros. Just to be able to tell. what matters to us is so the Mari Beirav basically says, yeah, you're allowed to confess and whip you, and that's a good thing. So, right. So the whole right. So he just thinks the halacha, the outcome is like that. The outcome is like that. Shuvat Agonim. Right, and it's pushed to him that so. And again, I think that once you accept the proposition that I can walk into Bezdin, right, that I can walk into Bezdin and say I confess, right, I did this, please whip me. The notion that you can prove from the failure to accept Odas Baldin that you don't own your body is impossible. I don't know if you can argue the reverse, The fact, right? Because you can argue, no, it's only for kapara. That doesn't mean you have absolute autonomy, right? But it doesn't. But it certainly doesn't prove the reverse. And then the Ralbach, who disagrees, right? But he disagrees. But he says himself, right, in the underlying section, he says, right? He says that he thinks that in fact, it's perfectly mutter to hit somebody for the sake of kapara. He just thinks that these malchus won't give you kapara, right? So this is purposeless, right? If you walk into court and, right, and get whipped by a bezin without smuchin, you're getting whipped for no reason at all, and that you can't do. Right? But once you have a purpose involved, there's no problem at all. There's actually no machlokes about the question of whether you can arrange for malchus for kapara. And that, again, I think doesn't fit with the notion that failure to accept confessions is evidence of anything. Right? Failure to accept confessions is evidence of evidentiary standards. And that's it. Okay, so the last thing we have is the Rimigash, and then we really... Rimigash says, Ruvain ratzal alot l'eretz Yisrael, v'nadar shlo yochal b'tzav l'yishtay yayin at shiyal l'eretz Yisrael, chutz min shabbatot v'yom tov. Yorein rabbeinim Ruvain ze over b'yoto noder. Right? Somebody made a neder to be in quasar avelus until he makes aliyah. Okay? Now, this is actually, to me, a wild tshuva. Right? What's wrong? Right, what, you know, it's a wild tshuva. Why would you think this is wrong? Right, you know, it's a fairly, you know, if we did this for a day, right, it'd be an eder to take a tannis, right? This is a wild thing. And Rimigash says, Misha Nadarze Avar al Divrei Torah, V'chol Yom Shu Meid B'Nidrohu Ver V'chol Tev Nafsho. It's wild, right? V'atora lo hitir l'adam sheyitza'er atzmo.
Maybe it was
anti-tzioni. Maybe Rimigash was anti-tzioni. Could be. you know, if he had said something else, he doesn't say it's because of the tenai, but if he was not there, the exact same thing, until he goes to a Met game or something like that, that would work. But maybe. The ein hefresh bin mishum mitzair nafsho and mishum mitzair chaviro. Well, the sibah zo ein adam chayav b'mashu model atzmo b'mashu chayav mital malkot kimish ku chayav b'mashu model al atzmo mamon. Okay, so now this is a very interesting line. Which is? How can you testify against somebody else? Yes, you can ask that question, especially since he says, "Bein hefresh for mishum mitzair nafsho, mishum mitzair chaviro." But here he does say it. Right? So do you have any way at it? Right, he sets up a prohibition against causing yourself pain. Now he doesn't tell you. He doesn't frame this in terms of ownership, right? He leaves out the rationale. He doesn't say it's because you don't own your body. All he says is that there is a prohibition against causing yourself pain, in the same way that there's a prohibition against suicide, essentially. So the question is, do we think that the only ground for that claim is an assertion that you don't, right, is an assertion that you don't own your body? And will we move from that assertion to claims that, right, that, right, to claims that limit your autonomy in terms of medical areas? Yes, David.
I mean, in all of these cases, like, halacha is not pure capital, like, say, restrictive imagination.
Right.
On all of your private property, halacha places restrictions on what you can do with it. So in any of these cases that suggest that you don't own your body, you can always say, well, you do own your body, but God places so many restrictions on what you could do with your body that it has the same effect as if you didn't own it. So you could always explain it that way and make it not tally on the formal shame violence.
Absolutely. And if this tshuva only said, right, that you cannot cause yourself pain unnecessarily or purposelessly in the same way you can't commit suicide purposelessly, then it wouldn't stand for very much. But the interesting thing to me is, but this person has a real purpose. Now, the purpose of doing this is to motivate them to go on aliyah, right? Or to express their, to embody their attachment to Eretz Yisrael. So what interests me, right, is what Adi said here is, right, is valuable, right? It is, suppose somebody said, I refuse, right, takes the same neder and says, I refuse to do this, until I have succeeded in finishing Shas. Right? Or until I have succeeded in overcoming my temper. Right? Or until I have, right, din vaker 633 cholim. Right? Something which explicitly says I'm doing this, right? I'm doing this for the I'm doing this for religious good. Is the problem that does the Rimagash really believe that there are no goals for which it would be legitimate to impose this on yourself? Right? Because there's an absolute prohibition against causing yourself pain? That would be very interesting. That would be very interesting. You can't say, he says purposelessly, because I think Aliyah, everyone recognizes Aliyah is a goal, is a reasonable value to have. Okay, yes.
I think that the Rimi Gas is looking at this with tunnel vision. In other words, he sees the word Neder, all of a sudden he thinks Rabbi Lozer HaKaparashit about Nedarim. He doesn't even look at the Eretz Yisrael part. You want to take a Neder to withhold meat or wine from yourself? We don't like Nedarim. Judaism doesn't like Nedarim. Nedarim are bidya, but not Al-Kasila, don't do it.
We all take Nedarim to fast. Every time it's Tiber, we're all taking Nedarim to fast. He knows about Bahav. Does he oppose Bahav?
But I don't necessarily think that you can ask him what he thinks about the situation, how it compares to the... When it's very clear, I mean, he fights the Gemara himself. He sees someone wanting to take a Nedar. He's looking at that Gemara. That's his gut reaction. He doesn't mention the Eretz Yisrael thing at all in his tshuva. He just mentions Nedarim, and it's bad to take Nedarim.
No, he says it's bad to take Nedarim for things that are awesome.
Well, at the end, he spends a lot of time like being powerful rhetoric against this guy, right? You know, it's really powerful rhetoric.
But he's all from those Gemaros in Nedarim about Rabbi Lozer.
It is. It is. You have to look at the other Shuvot and see if he really opposes all Nedarim. I wouldn't have that instinct. But you have to look at his other Shuvot.
Even if you look at his other Shuvot, I mean, he could have just been feeling like Rabbi Lozer Hakapar that day. I don't necessarily think that context is necessarily the best way to.
But what happens? What would you think he would have said if somebody had said, "I'm not Beli Neder, I won't eat meat or wine," the person just asks, "Is this a Hanhaga Tova?" Right? Wouldn't he still have said, "No, the Torah doesn't permit you to be Mitzar yourself"?
I don't think he would have said that. No.
You think it would have entirely been Neder? Okay.
Because that's all of the rhetoric he's using is coming from.
Not the first line. The first line is a Torah lo hitira l'adam sheyetza eretz mo.
But his basis is those Gemara. So.
Then why does he connect it to Modeh, right, to Hodat Baldin? Why is that relevant? If he just thinks a bad Neder, Hodat Baldin is not a relevant category. Hodat Baldin is a flourish.
Yeah.
I think Neder is the second argument. It's right, the first six lines have nothing to do with Neder. Five lines have nothing to do with Neder, and then he throws in Neder at the end.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, so I'm not convinced. You can resurrect it later if you want. Yes, Ron?
It's really saying that the Lord is here and brings the Nadir, because he's always to say that Nadir, he might dislike the Nadir, but he's allowed to. He's allowed the action.
That's true. He doesn't claim the Neder is not Chal.
Yes, Chal.
Right. The Neder is Chal, but it's a bad idea, right? He has a, right? Which, on, you know, on the other hand, which strengthens the idea that what's going on is a broader philosophic principle, right? Not narrow halakha. Right? He has some kind of meta-halakhic principle, right? The Neder is Chal, it's not... He can't say that it's... the Noder Keneged HaTorah, right? The Lachal Meikaro. He says, right, sort of Tzrichin L'Shachneo, so, right? Right, to... I don't know, the Rimagash is more troubling to me than most of the other Makaras, because he draws an explicit connection, right? He's not trying to rationalize, right? The Radbaz is trying to rationalize Hodat Baldin, and the Balatanya is trying to rationalize, right, the prohibition of Chavala. But the Rimigash is not trying to rationalize anything. Right, the Rimigash is creating, right, to me there's a difference between people who come up with explanations of halakha that already is, and people
who use their rationale to produce a halakha. The Rimi Gash is more valuable than the others because he's producing a halakha. Nothing about halakhic precedent requires him to say this. What he says is, I think this neder is wrong because I have this principle that I know from elsewhere. Right? And which I see, and I see this tzak as continuing a pattern that I see as having halakhic significance. So the Rimi Gash to me is a stronger claim than the others. But he still talks about pain and not health. Pain, right? Pain and pleasure, right? He doesn't say it's a mitzvah la negatzmo. He just says asrula dam shitza eretzmo. Right? So I don't know that there's necessarily a converse mitzvah to say.
Oh,
but it's the deprivation of being wine. Interesting question how you view it that way. I'm not... I think that that's the way out of the Rimi Gash. Secondly, the Rimi Gash never tells you what his rationale is. Right? His rationale may not be ownership. His rationale may be something entirely different. His rationale may be simply that he thinks that Asur Ladam, right, to not Gehana Melamazet. And something with your body. Right? He may just think there's a religious chiyuv to benefit from God's bounty in the world, and you're failing to benefit from God's bounty in the world. Nothing to do with ownership of the body, right? So I think that on the one hand, the Rimi Gash convinces me that he means something serious in a way that the others don't. But on the other hand, I think that whether the something serious he means is the same as what Dr. Steinberg wants, that is not so clear to me because he may have nothing to do with right. It seems to me, since he doesn't mention that rhetoric at all, right? It seems now the only issue is that my explanation doesn't fit so well with the connection to Hadad Baldin. The connection to Hadad Baldin seems to imply that it's not an issue of benefiting; it's an issue of limitation on your rights. It does seem right. So, I would say is that there's a long way to claim that the Rimi Gash has a philosophic principle he never enunciates as a chiddush. To move from saying that you can't deny yourself pleasure to saying that you have to keep that you have to always maximize your health is a chiddush. Even if you were to say that the reason that you can't cause yourself pain is that you don't own your body. Of course, he doesn't really mean that you can't cause yourself pain for anything. Right? So we still have to figure out what the gradations of that are. But with all that, I have to admit that the Rimi Gash does seem to enunciate some kind of principle which imposes broader obligations on you in relationship to your body than any of the other sources have. I think I'm comfortable admitting that. Although my suspicion is that in the end, that he's based on right, he's not based on that kind of principle. I suspect, but I need what I'm looking for, I guess, is a better connection. Right? I need a different formulation that adequately explains what the connection is between banning fasting and not allowing yourself to confess. Right? If it's not ownership of the body, right? What is it that generates that? Right? Why is that different than money? I think it's reasonable to construct a prima facie case that behind there must be some notion of ownership in some way. So that's why I would leave us there. I'd say that we have to be modeid with the Rimi Gash. And then once you concede the Rimi Gash, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is coming out of one aspect of the Rimi Gash, right? Which is the Tzar aspect, and the Radbaz is coming out of the second aspect of the Rimi Gash, which is the Hodas Baldin aspect, and then we can view them, which independently they don't come out of anywhere. Right, but if you look at them as stemming from the Rimi Gash, you could actually construct a tradition. Right, whether that is a
whether that is a dispositive tradition, right, a binding tradition, so that we say because you have this Rimigash which bifurcates into the Shulchan Aruch HaRav and the Radbaz, therefore we derive far-reaching conclusions about the nature of medical practice today. That seems to me a lot further than I'm willing to go, but at least it grounds that position. Right? If you can see that's what the Rimigash is saying, then it grounds that position. All right, and that's where we'll end. Now we will assume that we're not going to. Tomorrow, we just want you to prepare, and we'll have a hashgacha shiur on. Assuming I find the right page by then, on the intersection of the Vartura by Rav Meir Shapiro and Rav Dessler, on the notion of machloket nagada and how machloket nagada relates to machloket nalacha. So we'll do that like 11:15-ish or so tomorrow. But tomorrow you should just go on and prepare the Makor, and we'll have the next regular shiur on Monday. And also, if some of you have lots of stuff to prepare on your own, so if you want to, right, if you're reasonably caught up with the Makor and you need tomorrow morning to prepare your own shiurim, then that is legitimate as well. All right, time to throw projectiles around.
Skirting around the main issue, which is the Kabbalah of Atzmon. So here, when are we getting to that?
Next week.
Because it seems to me like all these issues I could kind of explain one way or another. I can't explain Kabbalah.